Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions. And today we have an episode of the Open Books series in which we talk to interesting and fascinating and inspiring people in the actuarial community and get to know them through the books that they have read and loved. Today is a special episode of Open Books because over the next few months we'll be celebrating Insight's 10th birthday. And today I'm privileged to be joined by none other than the CEO of Insight Actuarial Solutions, Christoph Roth. Christoph is a well-renowned health actuary, and in his 20-plus year career, he has consulted to some of South Africa's most prominent medical schemes, administrators, and managed care organizations. Christoph is also currently serving on the ASIC Council. And when he's not at work, he's father to three beautiful girls, an 8-year-old and 7-year-old twins. And he's also a man of many interests and talents, including playing the piano, mostly jazz. Welcome, Christoph. Well, actually, usually I would say welcome, but I'm on your turf today, so thank you for having me.
Oh, welcome. Yeah. I must say, you make me sound a lot more interesting than I thought I was. Thank you for putting that off.
We haven't even got into the interesting facts yet. I'm saving those for later. But tell me, are you a reader?
I would have to respond to that question in the affirmative, but with a qualification. That's what us actuaries do. We disclaim and qualify.
State your assumptions and limitations. Yeah.
And then send a disclaimer and also an invoice. That's what... I'm a reader, but I unfortunately or fortunately, probably for the last 8 years or so, I found myself progressively graduating from being a reader to a listener. And maybe just by necessity, and because especially pre-COVID, spent a lot of time traveling between clients, literally hours every day on the road, and started taking, you know, as Audible and Bluetooth audio in cars have become more prevalent, I just found it's an exceptionally, you know, it takes some getting used to maintain your concentration, I guess, on a, especially if it's a complicated book, but... found that the number of books that I can consume in a short space of time just by listening to it is just much, much more productive than sitting and reading. So, yes, if that counts, then I'll say I'm a reader. We could debate.
I think that is a question we need to talk about because I'm still skeptical of audiobooks, but consensus does seem to be that audiobooks does count as reading. And people often cite, you know, the oral traditions of storytelling, you know, predates any, you know, written books. So,
oh, that's an interesting view. Yeah,
yeah.
I get it. Now, look, I have a strange habit that it might sound really stupid, but if I really enjoy an audiobook, then I always buy the hard copy as well. Sometimes I literally just put it on my shelf. You know, sometimes there's some graphs or photographs or stuff that are useful to look at. Like in a biography, you normally have some photograph pages often in the middle or whatever. But I actually just buy the book because I love to. This is the book that I'm reading. I want to prove. Maybe I just want it all on my bookshelf so, you know, people can see it. Bragging rights.
These books become your personality. But actually, you know, audiobooks probably speak quite closely to the origins of this podcast or the inspiration for this podcast concept, because it was inspired by Desert Island Discs, where people bring their favorite music and, you know, talk about their lives in between. So I guess we're going back to our roots with this episode. Zoe, we'll be talking to you and hearing about your career journey and the things you're busy with, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in a way. But before we get into those, tell me, what is keeping you busy these days?
I think you just mentioned Insight in its current guise and its current form is turning 10 this year. I can't believe it's turning 10 years old. And you've just reminded me that I'm getting old. You mentioned a 20-year-long career, which is not sure if it's a compliment, but I decided I'll take it as one.
Well, what's the alternative?
The alternative is having hair. I would say, which I don't have anymore. Or as I like to put it, you know, there's a point in a man's life where you realize you're starting to shave this part of your face and not this part of your face. And so I've now transitioned into that domain, I guess. But to get back to your question, over the past 10 years, Insight has just grown spectacularly. We launched Insight with its current brand in its current form in August 2014, probably one of the metrics of growth might be the headcount, especially in a consulting environment where your client list and your revenue and your staff complementing to kind of move in step. And we were about 20 or maybe 25 people back in 2014. We've recently pushed beyond 100 headcount across the whole group of companies, because we have a group of companies now, including Insight Life Solutions, which you head up, which is also contributing to the headcount. And the interesting thing, if you ask what's keeping me busy, is, I guess that's par for the course, but predominantly people keeping me busy. People. And the kinds of, I guess, I miss some of the hardcore actuarial analytics and consulting, but at the same time, I really enjoy the challenges that comes with growth and establishing a culture and establishing a common vision and an identity and a motivation and a purpose, which are things that kind of happen automatically when you're small.
And
they have to be, I guess, fostered and created more deliberately as you grow. Okay. And that's probably what's keeping me more busy than I thought it would ever.
Not only for selfless reasons, I'm very interested to get some leadership advice in this conversation. But before we get into that in the books, I'd like to hear a bit more about your reading habits. So can you describe your perfect reading setting? Or listening setting.
Yeah. There's it's been a while, and maybe also because I have, as you said, three young kids. They're now twins aged 7 and another one aged 8. And finding like a quiet spot in the windowsill with a soft sunlight, just paging with a cup of tea, that's just not happening. You know, like, so I don't have that opportunity. If I'm at home,
take this on.
to really have I think for me today, right now, it would be a real luxury to even just be able to take a few hours just to read. Yeah. Even in holidays, you know, there's constantly some motion, something going on. So that's where the audiobook, I guess, substitute, you know, becomes quite useful. So before COVID, lots of time in the car. And again, you know, it was when lockdown started, I recall quite distinctly, we started the hard lockdown in March 2020, wasn't it? 26 March.
Yes.
And I remember shortly after that, I was working from home and I said to my wife, I can't believe it, but I just have like 2 or 3 hours every day that I didn't used to have. And I realized that was apart from my commute. There was a time that I was spending, because the tradition in a consulting environment, especially before COVID, was that you go to your clients. Some of them are in Victoria, some are in Joburg. It's very easy to gobble up 2 or 3 hours of traveling time. And those tended to be, you know, you're stuck in traffic, and one way to get to productively use the time in a car would be listening to audiobooks. I have one other vice, but I can recommend it, and that's when you go to bed. And especially, you know, I wouldn't suggest you do it out of habit, but I think there are some nights where, this is my experience, you know, those nights where you can't get your brain to calm down, you're kind of tossing and turning and thinking about everything that could possibly go wrong. I don't know if that happens to you, but sometimes with that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I found that, again, especially with wireless Bluetooth buds, pop one of them into your ear, think carefully about which book you select. But what it does is it forces your mind to kind of come back and grounds it in one domain, which is the book that you're listening to. And I found that's a very useful tool to just get your brain to calm down and say, okay, we're going to focus on this. And 15 or 20 or 30 minutes later, you would have listened to something and be closer to falling asleep, I guess.
Sounds like a form of mindfulness practice or meditation.
Maybe a little bit, yeah. I think what it does is it at the very least, it's not meditation in the sense of seizing thought the way you should when you meditate, I guess, but it does prevent your mind from just scatterbraining all over the place.
Yeah.
And bringing you to one space. Yeah.
Which genres do you tend to gravitate towards?
Let's go back to like high school. And is that okay?
Yeah.
It'll make it a long answer. But, you know, I was, a normal stereotypical boy in school who liked like science fiction and maybe a little bit of fantasy. I didn't like fantasy too much because it must at least be like theoretically possible.
Okay. You know, okay.
Like Dragon of the Magic Wands, not really, but you know, if it's a science, I read some fantasy, but mainly science fiction. I really enjoyed it. I heard Louis Rousseau in his podcast mentioned Fritz Dielman. I read it's like a, it's an Afrikaans book. It was written in the 80s, I guess, very idealistic about the future. I think it probably supposed to play off in the early 2000s, but where the South African police flies with supersonic jets and stuff. It's like a little bit different than we thought it would be. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with optimism. I also, in high school, like one of my hobbies and one of my pet interests was computer programming. I was, you know, before I made...
punch cards.
I'm not that old. I'm at least beyond punch cards. But we were using stuff like BASIC and later Turbo Pascal, maybe even a little bit of assembler, and later C. But what, this is before C sharp or C++, so I guess as old as that, the C without. Do you know why it's called C, by the way?
No.
Kernighan and Ritchie, the two people who designed the programming language C, they started with the programming language, which they called A, because they couldn't come up with a better name. And then they made some enhancements to it, and then they called that one B. And then later they called another one C.
Oh, sure. Okay. And that's why they took off.
And the C kind of stuck. And then we had C++, which is a pun, really, because the plus operator in C increases the variable one. This is so unnecessary, like such a digression. But C sharp, of course, which is the object oriented version that many people know today. But when I was in high school, it was virtually impossible to find any guidance or any literature on how to code. We had like acquaintances of ours, neighbors, one of my parents' friends who were like into computers, and he had some books which I borrowed. But if I found a book, it was like a treasure trove of like, you know, there was limitations and you had to do with this. You couldn't Google a problem. I don't think we appreciate how lucky we are today.
Yeah.
And my local library, we blew up in the east of Pretoria, so there were kind of two libraries. Like, there was nothing on computer programming there. So I would, and I shouldn't say this because it does make me sound as nerdy as I was, or, you know, still sometimes try to be, but I literally took programming books and coding books, if I could find them, on holiday with me. People think that's why I never picked up girls on the beach, because I was literally lying on the beach. And that's not the right way to impress, I guess, during high school. But, you know, that was me. So that's high school. I guess when I am into university as well, and for me, Google kind of started, search engines and the web became accessible around my second, third, fourth, fifth year in university. They were there before, but that's when it became a little bit more mainstream. When I started out doing work, I started reading a lot of business literature. I think I brought an example here of what I don't think is not so good business literature. But I was interested in what makes companies succeed and not. And we can talk about that a little bit today. And I also found very quickly that you must approach any book, and I mean any book, with a degree of humility. It's like if you are young and fresh out of university, you tend to think that you know a lot. Smart, you know? And you're an actuary. You're an actuary. And maybe you didn't do too bad in your studies, and you were kind of close to the top of your class. So and then you read a book and you're like, wow, you know, what these insights here that I could never have dreamt. So I think today we can talk about it. It's like it's very important to be able to open your mind to any books, including and more particularly, especially today, if you look at how, you know, how polarized political discourse internationally has become, is to deliberately and systematically expose yourself to literature with which you disagree and try to see if you can stomach and see, try to get to see the other side of the, you know, you can feed yourself with so much reinforcement, a kind of proverbial echo chamber way of going about the world.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of wisdom in all of that. I didn't read any fiction. And and then later on, I would say about 8 years ago or so, I introduced a lot more of fiction into my diet.
I wonder why.
And I realized, you know, there's a lot of wisdom, of course, in fiction as well. And there's often some subtext there. But it's also just sometimes purely relaxing. One thing I think one of the triggers was Game of Thrones, and I started reading the actual George R. R. Martin books.
Okay.
The audiobooks are done extremely well, and I forgot the name of the narrator of the books. The narrator is very important when you listen to an audiobook. But I mean, there are so many characters in Game of Thrones, and the dude who's reading the Game of Thrones book, it's got a different voice for every one of. He does like 50 different voices.
And can you keep track of that?
And like 3 books later, he's still. I don't know how they do it. Oh, I think it is incredible.
What a talent!
Yeah, it's so with a good narrator. But you know, Game of Thrones has got an incredible, incredible deep political insight behind the entire plot. Song of Ice and Fire, I think, is the primary. Kind of theme underpinning it. I mean, I can, if you want, I can summarize this one central theme of what Game of Thrones is all about. And even in South African politics, Game of Thrones will provide you with very useful frames of reference. In American politics as well. There's a part in the whole Game of Thrones series which is referred to as Varys' Riddle. Varys was this kind of advisor to the king. And they were talking about a power struggle because the theme in Game of Thrones, because there are 7 different kings and all of them have a fairly legitimate claim on the throne, you know, through birthright or through some. Everyone has, and then there's just this mad competition where, as the queen says, you either win or you die, which is also true in politics, right? You either win or you die. But Varys posed this riddle and he said, imagine there are 4 people in a room. One is a king, one is a priest, and one is a rich man. And in the middle of the room is a swordsman, a soldier. And all 3 of these people, the king, the priest, and the rich man, instruct the soldier to kill the other 2. What's going to happen?
Now, listen to the rich man.
Yeah, so of course it's a rhetorical kind of question, which is tended, but you answered it very well. I would also I don't have to listen to the rich man. I don't know who, but the point being that the swordsman is in control, but he doesn't realize that he is in control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a fascinating thought exercise. So the swordsman might believe that the priest supersedes the king, or the other way around, or the rich man. But the belief which the swordsman is holding, for reasons that he might not even comprehend or understand, is actually, you know, determining who's in power. And that's how politics work. You know, like the electorate.
The people.
The people have the power. They don't realize they have the power, but they have the power. And the belief of the people will decide how things played out. It's this power is a mystery. It's like a shadow on the wall, I think is what he says. And that little riddle, that thought exercise, to me, that's the core of the entire Game of Thrones series, or the books, the Songs of Ice and Fire books by George R. R. Martin.
Yet those are not ones that you brought along today.
You've covered
books we don't like, books, fantasy books, business books, books about, you know, opinions are different from your own. Which book shall we start with today?
Yeah, so I grabbed a fairly random pile of books. We could have brought some others, and I quite deliberately made them kind of random. So I'm not trying to come here with a theme. I'm also not really trying to come here with a very work-related. I guess we could talk about NHI and about actuarial studies and a bunch of those things as well. The books by Nassim Taleb are probably closer to that, but I want it to be quiet, if you don't mind. I think we can just be all over this.
Yes.
And I'm going to start with the book by M. Scott Peck. I don't know why American people do this with their initials.
And some Afrikaans people do that also.
Yeah, and like anyone has Gerardus, Stephanus.
But call me Piedras.
But yeah, exactly. And I just want, for the record, I only have one name. And I'm truly thankful my parents decided to not give me a multiplicity of names because they also didn't see the sensibility. And my three daughters all also have one name. Easily spellable, easily pronounceable. As you see, there's a double. How do you pronounce pronounceable? See what just happened there?
Pronunciation.
This is by M. Scott Peck. So I don't know why you start with the initial and then put your name and your, but you know, I guess if you choose your second name. This book is probably not that profound. Can we show it to the camera? Can we see?
Yes.
Is it like a, I don't know where there's a picture of a flower.
The Road Less Traveled.
Well, and it matches your attire very, very closely. That's completely irrelevant and unplanned. But The Road Less Traveled is, I guess, a book that just really spoke to me when I was fairly young, either, let's say 24, 25 years old. And still today, I find myself quoting from it quite often. And there's a couple of themes that Scott Peck is a psychologist. I think the central thesis of this book is actually to say that anyone, whether you're perfectly happy or unhappy or kind of centered and grounded or a little bit crazy, anyone can benefit from psychotherapy.
Can?
Right. That I think that's, well, it's written by a psychologist, so I guess he had a conflict of interest when he made that statement. But it's a fairly compelling. The book is divided in four parts. The first part deals with discipline. The second part deals with love. And the third and the fourth parts deal with, I think, grace and religion, actually. He kind of makes an interesting, very analytical case, which one might or might not agree with. We can talk about that as well for, you know, whether God exists or not and where everyone should think about religion, etc. But I want to focus on the first half of the book and the part of discipline. With the first three words in the book, you can read it for us.
I think I remember.
Yeah.
Life is difficult.
Life is difficult. And then he proceeds to say that, you know what, life is difficult, but once you recognize that it is difficult, then it becomes less difficult. And the whole book is to say, look, life isn't easy. Don't expect it to be easy, but, you know, use some tools and some ways of thinking about it. He starts by talking about discipline, saying, you know, the way to apprehend the difficulty of life is to apply some discipline. And, you know, he talks about self-discipline. That's the first part of the book, which I'm now trying to recall from memory, but there's four parts that he talks about. The first is delayed gratification, which is fairly obviously the definition of discipline, citing some research about even how kids who are happy to wait to eat the pudding after the main meal, you know, that's
already a start.
Yeah, all of those things.
Yeah.
Then the second is what he talks to about a dedication to reality, which is to say accepting reality for what it is, and the world keeps on changing, and you need to, each of us have like a mental map of how we think the world works, and that needs to be updated. And as you grow older, it gets harder to accept that things change. But it's he portrays it as a part of self-discipline that you have to deliberately impose on yourself. It's like the world keeps on changing and you must accept it and allow it to keep.
And you don't have control over those changes.
And very importantly, you don't. Right. So, and you resist it. And there's a lot there there's one thing there that I think I want to talk about more, but just to get to discipline, the third element of discipline or self-discipline that he talks about is acceptance of responsibility, which sounds fairly trivial, but what he suggests is, I think it's profound. You know, you are either responsible for something that happens or not. It's a little bit similar to the old Stephen Covey idea of the circle of influence. There are some things that you can control and some things that you can't control. And if something bad happens, say, you must, before you, some people have a tendency to accept too much responsibility. So something bad happens to you that's not your fault, but you blame yourself for it. That he calls neuroticism, of course. You see, you know, taking responsibility for things that are not your responsibility. On the other hand, you have what he would call a personality disorder, what I would call psychopathy, I guess, a Sorry, I'm Afrikaans. But a personality disorder, we would still have people who do not take responsibility for things that they are responsible for. And the point that he makes is a constant balance and a constant forceful, deliberate act of deciding what you take responsibility for and what not. It's an extremely powerful thought. So anecdotally, I can tell you, when I grew up, there was one point where my mother took a friend of mine from one place to another in my father's car, and she was involved in a motor vehicle accident. No one was hurt, but the car was a write-off. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't her fault at all. She was the third or fourth car to go over the intersection. They'd done a green traffic light, and another car came from the side and just complete write-off. So no one was hurt. Everything is fine, except the car wasn't. She felt so bad. It wasn't her fault at all. But she kept on saying things like, you know, if I only took the other route. That's an example of the more neurotic version of the response. And again, on the other side, you get people who do horrible things and, you know, push over other people and then don't feel any sympathy for that at all. And that's on the personality disorder side. But this acceptance of responsibility, the balance between neuroticism and personality, so he portrays it as like constant, deliberate, I guess, process that you need to think about. Interesting thoughts. And the fourth element of discipline is what he calls balance, or the discipline of disciplines. So, you know, don't all work and no play.
Everything in moderation, including moderation.
No, including moderation. Exactly. So that's it's very well written. It's very profound. It's very useful. And there's a lot of utility in there. And he then proceeds to, in the second part, to discuss love. A very brave man to try and define what love is. It's not a very romantic definition.
Okay.
He defines love as the process of sacrificing yourself through the, you know, the imposition of discipline for the benefit of someone else. And so, you know, you can apply this to a romantic relationship, of course, but I guess he's also applying it to, let's say, a mother and a father, quote unquote, pushing a child out of the household, which is painful to do. He makes the point that the sacrificial part of love is always painful. It's a self-sacrificial act. It's an absurd way to define love. But he sticks to it. He says, you know, I know this is a strange definition, but I'm going to make the case, and I think he makes a very compelling case to say that is what love is. And, you know, maybe you'll agree or maybe you won't, but it's definitely a good feed.
What is he referring to when he says the road less traveled?
I think that poem by, we did the poem in English, and it was, if you Google it, you'll find the poem. Sure. You know, it's a poem about someone who walked in the forest, and there was a road, and there was a split in the road, and the one was a well-worn kind of easy, and the other one was not so, you know. He said, I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's the poem. Then, if we had time, we could Google, but the listeners can Google the origin of that poem.
Okay, so his kind of way of living and discipline, and the road less traveled.
Maybe I think that's what he never touches on it in the book, but I think that's what he's implying there.
Okay, what's the next book we're going to?
Are you going to choose the? Many of these books are well known, and of course, many listeners have already read these. But I'll give my kind of one sentence synopsis of each. Nassim Taleb is a brilliant author, unfortunately also arrogant, but one can look past the arrogance. When he wrote his very first book called Fooled by Randomness, or the first one in this kind of series of four books that are fairly famous by today, there was still a little bit more humility here.
So it became more arrogant.
And the second book was The Black Swan, and then we got Anti-Fragility, which is also brilliant, and then we got Skin in the Game, which is also good. They're all excellent books. For book number 2, 3, 4, you're just going to have to deal with a fair amount of arrogance, I guess. But Fooled by Randomness is just, for actuaries, such a good read, suggesting that we attribute way too much to causality, including our own success. You know, it's like the sunscreen song where he says, everyone, don't berate yourself or don't give yourself too much credit if you're successful, and don't berate yourself either, because everyone's, what does he say, everyone's success is half chance. And that's what Fooled by Randomness say. And he comes from a trading background, so he uses the example of successful traders. So they're not successful, they are just lucky. But they think it's them. It's not. And he uses Monte Carlo simulation to demonstrate that a dentist is more wealthy on average than a trader.
Okay.
Well, because of the lack of randomness.
I mean, no volatility.
Exactly, yeah.
It reminds me of actuarial exams. If I was actually having this conversation yesterday. If you pass an actuarial exam, yes, it's because of you, but there's always an element of luck involved as well.
Yeah, yeah. And people do that. I think it's a survival mechanism. You know, we attribute things to ourselves or to luck or blame someone else, depending on what suits us. But, you know, there's more than just reflecting on your own career in there. There's all kinds of causal inferences that we make on a daily basis that might be purely random events. I'll give you, you mentioned that I play piano. So in the music industry, I would suggest that there is virtually zero causality if we want to determine what the next hit song in music is going to be.
I've often wondered about that.
I think it is, look, I would say there's a sub-minimum of like songs, into especially today, songs that meet a certain minimum criteria. But once you've met that minimum criteria, this is going to sound cynical, but I'd say the point, like which songs go viral from there, is entirely random. Entirely. We think, oh, this is the best band ever. They did it. No. And people go after that and analyze what they've done. And you know, it's not the lyrics. No, it's not the chord structure. It's none of those things. There's a point, once you've met the sub-minimum, unfortunately, I think, you know, it's another discussion, but I think music today has become a little bit more dumbed down than it used to be. But there's that point where when things go viral, it's really random. And of course, sheep theory, where the flock kind of goes where the flock is going, but also supports the whole viral nature. So that's another example of randomness, where we would attribute success to the artist, which was purely a result of randomness.
Does it feed into the argument of the existence of free will or not? Is there a connection there?
There might be a little bit. I think the two are maybe a little bit adjacent, but yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the whole free will question is one that we could spend an hour or two talking about.
Well, what's your one word answer?
That's free will exists. You know what? I'm going to say, I don't know. I'm going to go with, I don't know. I'm not convinced. On the kind of Sam Harris side of the spectrum, there's a strong thesis that free will does not exist. But at the same time, that side of the spectrum also suggests that consciousness is an illusion, and that that consciousness, which we don't fully understand, is simply an artifact that arises out of complex computation. That's an important question at the moment, is with the advent of AI. And actually, Roger Penrose wrote a brilliant, brilliant book. What is it called? The Emperor's New Mind or something like that. And he wrote about 15 years ago. Okay. I think Roger Penrose might be the most intelligent person alive right now. Sir Roger Penrose, that's that. And he's not satisfied, Roger Penrose, he's not satisfied with like the consciousness definition suggesting that it just arises out of computation. Because, you know, the Sam Harris view would be kind of, it's substrate independent. And if you can just take a bunch of neurons and connect them together the same way your brain is connected, or like you can do it electronically, then you would have a conscious entity right there. And Penrose is not satisfied with that. And, you know, and really, I say I don't know. I'm not sure who of them are right. I think there's still some discoveries to be made there, some research to be done. And I think the answer to that question might also determine whether we can go back and say free will exists or not. The Sam Harris argument on free will becomes very convoluted, because it's like you don't have free will, but you have the illusion of free will, so it is like free will, so you know, you can still be held accountable for what you've done, but you can't, you know, that's, yeah, it's a long discussion.
Okay.
That you really want to go down that rabbit hole.
I think you'd lose me very quickly. I want to talk about the book that you would not recommend.
Business literature. Oh, absolutely. I've looked at some MBA case studies. I think they're useful. This is an old book by Jim Collins called Good to Great. And he also wrote Built to Last. I think that's where he is.
Rolls off the tongue.
These are not bad books. The subtitle, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't. The problem with these kinds of books is something only actuaries, I think, should appreciate, is exposure. They don't adjust for exposure. Do you think one should adjust for exposure?
Of course.
Yeah, I think exposed, right? Yeah. So, the typical, I'm oversimplifying and I'm being a little bit disingenuous here, but the typical business research book goes like, there once was this company, and they were in trouble, but then they did this, and then they were successful. There was this other company, and they were in trouble, but they did this, and then they were successful. Oh, wonderful. Like, really? And then you attribute causality to that? It's like we're back with Byron. It's okay, give me all of the other companies who also did that and failed. And then we can start, simulating a randomized controlled trial and saying that maybe there's a little bit of causality that we can attribute. All business books do that. They are useful. I don't want to discount them. I think what business books do is give you a little bit of a frame of reference and a memory of the future and some artifacts and some language.
Yeah.
And then the kinds of situations that can arise in business where you can be like, I've seen that before. I recognize that. And there's sometimes very abstract artifacts that kind of emerge in the way you deal with people or clients, or business transactions can be formed, or the kind of legal disputes. It's very useful to have seen some of them. And I guess, the typical MBA curriculum, and I haven't done an MBA and I don't plan to, but the typical MBA curriculum is a lot about just reading case studies. This one little company, and this is the story, and this is what happened. And these books all do that, and I don't think they adjust for exposure. So I'm terribly unconvinced. But this is one beautiful episode in Silicon Valley. If you haven't seen Silicon Valley, the sitcom or the series, it's just genius. It's brilliant. But where the company, this little startup company, is in trouble, and then one guy says, "But he's read in a business literature that you must pivot." Now, what does that even mean? Of course, you can, in hindsight, look at a few companies who pivoted and then they were successful. Great. What is that? No, that's it there. Okay, let's pivot. Yeah, so that doesn't help you at all. Yeah.
Do you have a counter example, of a good business book?
I didn't bring one with me today. I do think, again, that there's a lot of good to learn from that, from the artifacts. I think a very valuable way to learn about business is doing biographies. And that's, I really enjoy that. I recently completed the Elon Musk biography, and the one thing I want to say about this is Walter Isaacson. I actually want to talk more about Walter Isaacson than Elon Musk. That book, highly recommended, but I want to say, if you hate Elon Musk, you will love this book. And if you love Elon Musk, you will also love this book. And that's why, because it is such a good book. And it unashamedly shows the good and the bad and the ugly and everything as it is.
Yeah.
Walter Isaacson did the same with his book on Steve Jobs. And I'm actually busy with his Einstein book. He wrote a biography of Einstein. I didn't even know that until I read this book. And he also wrote a biography, I think, of Leonardo da Vinci. But he's just such a good biographer. I think it is a skill. I think to summarize someone's life in a few pages.
Yeah.
It's not a few. You know, the one thing that you can't take away from this book, Elon Musk, the number of things that he's done. Because every chapter in that book is about a 5 minutes in Audible. But every chapter in this book could be a whole book on its own. So that's you have to summarize a lot to get to that. But he does it exceptionally well. And I think, again, you can learn there. You can see, because this is a warts and all. Walter does that. He does a warts and all biography, and those are his conditions. And look, Elon Musk doesn't come out like, he doesn't look like a hero all through the book. And if you read the Steve Jobs book, the biography Jobs, there's some moments there where you're going to hate, absolutely hate Steve Jobs. But the thesis of the book, I guess, is that those darker sides of some of these very high-profile CEOs as part of their success, like without some evil lurking in them, they wouldn't have been able to achieve what they have achieved, I guess, is part of what he's suggesting there.
Well, you two are like Elon Musk, you're a CEO from Pretoria. Do you have any other, would you say you have any other similarities with him based on how you bring?
Well, look, Elon Musk, I think there's good and bad, right? So, but I'll focus on the good. What I like about him might be maybe not the first thing most people would think about, but it's as if he retained a bit of his childishness, the kind of boyhood dreams of space and fast cars and. You know,
that's exactly, yeah.
Unashamedly, he continued to pursue those dreams when he grew up. Maybe I want to put it that way.
Okay.
You know, second, I think even though he's done some really, really strange things, especially since he acquired Twitter, and I still call it Twitter, and since he, sometimes way, I think, too deeply into politics, but I think the fundamental, to the degree that I can determine, the fundamental motivator for him is still to make humanity better, which I find strange because he had a really, really, really tough childhood growing up, with an abusive father and being bullied at school and a bunch of things. And yet his desire is to uplift humanity, I guess, including the people who bullied him, if you can put it that way. And he's kind of, his primary motivator, I guess it's a combination of just wanting to have fun. Initially, when he talked about establishing a colony on Mars, he was quite adamant that it's just about fun. Like, just to have something exciting. So, it's about saving the world, but actually, he says he wants life to be about more than just solving problems. And if for him to get up in the morning and think, I'm working about establishing a colony on Mars, that makes me excited. And we must have things that make us excited. You know, and he has a couple of quips to say, people say, yes, but there's hunger in the world and there's hardship and there's all of this. Shouldn't we use these resources towards that? And he said, yes, we should. But, the one response that I thought was quite, he said, maybe just, we can still take a tiny bit of money and allocate it to something exciting. Maybe less than we're spending on, like, lipstick. I don't know if that's inappropriate, but it was a nice way to kind of contextualize. But I think there's a playfulness and a desire to make the world a better place that is retained. And I think most of us lose that as we grow up. And look, we can say many other things about his intelligence and his ability to just inspire people on a large scale and to market without marketing, etc. But I think those are the main characteristics for me that stand out.
All right. I see... The next book, I see a very pristine copy. It looks like it's never been opened. Is this one of your audio books?
It's exactly that. A Conflict of Visions by Thomas Sowell. So I'm actually busy with the audiobook right now, and I only got through a few chapters when I thought, this is something, and I'll explain what. And then immediately I bought three copies, one that I'm sending to Barry, one that I don't know who I'm sending it to yet, and then one for me. And it's pristine because, yes, I'm listening to it. But I want to have the book.
Yeah, I know.
The part of this is not a recent book, This is from a while ago. See if there's an original publishing date here. But I am fascinated It says copyright 2007, but I thought it's even further back than that, 2007. I think in this day of political discourse and polarization, I'm deeply, deeply fascinated and a bit disturbed by, I want to understand what primarily drives this visceral conflict between left and right. You know? What is it? And without judgment, there's something deeper than just pro-life or pro-choice. Or, you know, let's talk, it's easier to talk about the Americans here because it's just fun to joke about them, I guess. But guns are not guns. And like one way to put it is to say, how is it that if I ask any American where they stand on gun rights, then I can predict where they stand on vaccines?
Yeah.
Like or climate change? Those things are completely independent. So clearly, if people were truly free thinking and approaching these problems from first principles, then it should be possible to be, you know, anti-termination of pregnancy, but at the same time, you know, have a different view about vaccines and a different view about climate change, a different view about guns. But we don't see that. You see this kind of tribalism clearly emerging, and that must mean that there's a deeper hidden variable, isn't it? That lies deeper than all of these things which are just bubbling to the surface. And I think what Thomas Sowell did here, the book is titled A Conflict of Visions. And, you know, it says the subtitle is Ideological Origins of Political Struggles. And I think what he's trying to do in the book, without judgment, is to describe what he calls two different visions. He says our vision as to how the world works will determine a lot of our beliefs in terms of what is justice and what is right and what is wrong and what is acceptable and what isn't. And I think he's right, like vision of how the world works is a much deeper phenomenon, you know, much more intrinsic to ourselves. And he describes, I'll just summarize, like he describes two visions, which he calls the constrained vision and the unconstrained vision. Okay. And the unconstrained vision would be the one that we would traditionally associate with a leftist kind of view, where he says, you know, with the right policies and the right money and the right people in the right places and the right structures in government, we can solve society's problems. We can solve inequality completely, you know. And that's what he calls unconstrained. It's his word. There could be a better word, maybe. And then he says the constrained vision, which we would probably call more right, is where you believe that there are only compromises. I don't know whether he associates with the latter because he's famous for that quote. But in this book, he's not really campaigning for left or right. He's just trying to describe one way of thinking about the world, one vision of the world, and then he tries to describe another. And I think he's hit a couple of very deep, I find it fascinating, just like having a proper understanding of, you know, what the fundamental root cause is for the kind of very, very deep disagreement. I mean, we're recording this podcast a week after the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, right? Which I guess is a symptom of just how ridiculously oppositional the social media is to blame and a lot of other things to blame. But I'm curious about why these differences are there. And I think he's stumbled upon something there.
Is it written in a way that's easy to follow, or is it quite heavy?
Yeah, it is a little bit on the heavier side. Okay. It's not too heavy, and I'm still busy with the book. I'm about halfway through. I just thought so much of what he kind of articulates. He's very articulate in the way that he describes it. Is useful in understanding a particular mindset, because I think one must put in an attempt, regardless of your personal beliefs or political persuasion. It's very useful to get a much deeper understanding of where people are coming from. Like I said at the beginning, you must expose yourself to things that you disagree with.
Oh, you've definitely piqued my interest with that. Maybe I'll be the recipient of your third.
Okay, I'll send you a copy, a pristine copy.
What's the last book we're going to talk about?
Yeah. I don't know. The other books I have here,
we can give them honorable mentions.
We can give them honorable mentions. Bad Blood is the story of Theranos, which is just such a good read. All of us know the story, but John Kirio just wrote this incredibly well. You can't believe it's a true story. recommend it just for fun.
Okay.
I mean, very recently, of course, Elizabeth Holmes was convicted, so there's all of that. But I just brought it because we all know the story, but it is so well written. It's
okay.
just absolutely brilliant. Sapiens or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Which one of these two are we going to do? Sapiens, brilliant. You've got to read everything Harari has written. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And he's got a very interesting thesis about what makes humans special.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes humans special, he says, is our ability to believe in fiction. And our ability to believe in fiction is what makes cooperation on a large scale possible.
Right.
Because there isn't something like the United States of America, yet 350 million people are cooperating. And this is like a symbol of a flag, and the United States dollar doesn't exist anywhere except in our minds with the South African rand. So it is fiction, our ability to believe in fictitious things, is what set the sapiens, the species human sapiens, apart from others. And it's a fascinating thesis, but it's also an exceptionally well-written book.
Yeah. It's accessible.
Yeah, very well-written.
Yeah.
Audiobook also brilliant. So good narrator. Always select audiobooks with good narrators. And if the author is the narrator, I can't stand it. I know you don't want to personally connect with it. No.
No.
There are limited exceptions. But, you know, I can watch a YouTube interview with the author if I wanted to. But get a good narrator.
Yeah, leave it to the Stephen Fry's of the world.
Yeah, ooh, Stephen Fry did Harry Potter.
Ooh.
If you've read the entire Harry Potter series, listen to the Stephen Fry version. His voice imbues the story with so much richness that he brings to it. It's incredible. He's a true artist. It's incredible what he's achieved with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So are we out of time? Or do you want to? This is The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, which I've selected. Look, Douglas Adams isn't with us anymore. And if you read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, it's like four books. When he released the fourth book, he said it's the increasingly accurately named trilogy of four. And, you know, that's not really funny. It's a little bit funny, but a lot of his jokes look like that in the surface. Because he would say things like, and the spaceships hung in the sky, much the same way that bricks don't. Again, it's funny. It's not so funny. And if you haven't read the books, do not ever watch the movie. It's the worst movie you could ever ask to watch. But there's a much deeper, I believe Douglas Adams was primarily a philosopher. And there's a much, much deeper philosophical underpinning, sometimes a little bit sad, below this. It's a meaning of life. And I think there are some really, really funny moments there. Do we have time for one quote?
Yes.
This is the second book, called The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. So this is just after the end of the first book, where the Earth is destroyed to make room for an intergalactic superhighway or something like this. But right at the beginning of the book here, I don't know if people can see, but you know, there's just one paragraph on the first page which says, there is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. And then you turn the page and it says there's another theory which states that this has already happened. And then I go on to chapter one, which starts with the story so far. It says, in the beginning, the universe was created. And then he says, this has made a lot of people very angry and been widely regarded as a bad move. That's enough. I don't need to read more. Maybe the classic, you know, nerdy joke about 42, of course, comes from Hitchhiker's Guide. And you know, the story is that people asked what is life and the universe and everything about, and they built this massive computer, and it took millennia, and it computed and computed, and then announced that it is ready to announce the answer, and the people gathered in front of the big computer, and it announced that the answer is 42. And, you know, on the surface, again, that might seem like a really slapsticky kind of a joke, but what the book suggests is what's much deeper, that the art in life is much more about asking the right questions than getting the right answers. So, you know, like, the real tricky part is not to get to the answer, but if the universe is the answer, then what is the question? I guess that's what he's suggesting. And that's not to ponder
as well. You know, we have all this data, but and it can tell you anything.
Absolutely,
what's the question?
And quite often, and you know, you as, like me is in the space of consulting. I think much more often than we think we do, we come up with the right questions. Your client will ask you these things, and you'll answer these questions, but you will infer from that that there's a much deeper question, and the real art is coming up with the right question. And if that's a, maybe that's one of the philosophical insights. There's another very interesting part of this book. I think at some stage, the protagonist encounters the biggest dictionary ever written, a dictionary of every language ever.
Yeah.
Which is printed on microfilm and still is kind of train trucks full of volume. And it has every word from every language ever. And then Douglas Adams says, like a footnote, strangely enough, the dictionary omits the word loopily, which means in the manner of something that is floopy. I'm glad you found it funny. I think it's really funny.
Well, I mean, the one practical thing I got from these books is always bring a towel.
Yeah, and don't panic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've
covered a lot of ground. I guess.
Conflict of Visions by Thomas Sowell, and yeah, a few honorable mentions as well. The restaurants, I guess the whole
series. It's not for everyone, but I would recommend that you give it a shot and just try to read between the lines a little bit.
And then we have Elon Musk's biography by Walter Isaacson. Good to Great, We're Not Going to Take With Us to the Desert Island. We have Fooled by Randomness and, you know, the whole Nassim Taleb series, I guess. And The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck. So,
you're holding great books there.
But we're going to send you to a desert island and you could only take one of them with you.
That's a trick question. I think what I would suggest is I'll take the one we've started. So, it is a simple book, but it's a profound book at the same time, Right There Struggled. And there's plenty here about the meaning of life and, you know, as I said earlier, down to questions about religion and origin and love and that sort of thing. So I think if I were stuck in a desert island pondering my fate, why, then at least there might be some, maybe not acceptable, but some answers here. So I would... Since you're holding a gun against my head and telling me I must choose only one, literally, I'll go with Scott Peck. He wrote some other books as well, by the way, but I think this was his magnus opus, which was quite good.
Amazing. And Christoph, if people want to connect with you or find out more about what you're doing.
We talked about many actuarial topics today, didn't we? Like, very actuarial stuff.
You work on council and challenges.
Yeah, exactly.
Insight.
No, my prof at university loved it to say that an actuary who is only an actuary is not an actuary. You've heard that before.
Yeah.
So I think it's appropriate that we just dabble a little bit around everything else. Now, I think since we're talking about actuaries and professional stuff, you can follow me on LinkedIn and also follow Insight on LinkedIn. We've just had our Foresight events here, which was wonderful. And I think right now there will be some content that we've published coming from our annual Foresight event. And I would recommend that people look at that as well. That might be the best way to connect.
In addition to that, Pam, can I suggest that people follow your podcast?
Yes, please. in Focus with Insights. Everywhere where you can find podcasts. But Christoph, thank you so much for talking to me about life, the universe and everything.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. We've enjoyed it.